This is The Mary Davis Show, a program that takes an inside look at what is happening in Western New York with interviews, news, special features, and the community calendar. Now, here is your host, Mary Davis.
Good morning and welcome. I'm your host, Mary Davis. The show, of course, is The Mary Davis Show. And just to warn my audience, there may be two others that are joining us, and I will put them on as soon as they get here. But right now, on our live line coming from Albany, New York, is Terry Melvin. And he is Secretary Treasurer of AFL-CIO in Albany. And with me in the studio is one that you're very familiar with. You're getting familiar with Terry, too. Terry Melvin. There's two Terrys, but this is Terry Melvin. And that's Gary Earl Ross, who is, of course, he is Professor Emeritus at SUNY. What's it? I can never get the name.
SUNY Buffalo Educational Opportunity Center.
Oh, he piped in on that. He's also an author, a playwright, and an actor, too. So he's all around. And Terry Melvin is, of course, he's just coming in. He's going into his second term now. Aren't you, Terry, your second year?
Second term.
Yeah, he's president of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. So I have these important people, and there's me. Mary Davis, I guess in this crowd, Miss Nobody, but you know I do my best.
Long-standing public commentator, Mary. That's no mean feat.
So when I want to remind everybody that you can see these same people, I hope, Terry Melvin is also a minister. I'm going to try to get him on television with me, along with Gary Earl Ross. That should be coming to you next Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday. So I put you on the spot, Terry. You can't really say no to me on air.
Oh, my.
But I promise we'll be right on time on Saturday. In fact, we've got to be because my producer is also a very Christian-type person who does he has his ministry. And when he warns me ahead of time that he has, you got to be there at 2 o'clock, I know that he's got something going on with his church. And other than money, his church is right up there. So that's that. So, Terry, I'll see you at 2 o'clock, right?
I guess so. I'll check my schedule, but I guess so.
Don't check any schedule. Just put me there. Gary, the same with you. I shall see you on Saturday, right?
Okay.
All right. That's it. We're talking this morning about two issues that I hope my guests are talking about. Both of them have been involved in unions. And it was an article in the Buffalo News Sunday before last, and it said, fight for $15 doesn't always lead to greater union membership. What sparked me is a person who used to be the civil rights person out of Detroit for UAW told me that one big problem they had that he was talking about his members. He said, you know, we fought so hard to get good paying jobs, good benefits and everything else for our union members. And as soon as they started making good money, they all turned into Republican conservatives. And I'm just wondering if that might be something that might be happening here. I would think not, since I guess you're trying to get $15. You are certainly not in a thing where you're getting rich. So what do you think about that, Terry? We'll start with you.
Well, I think your first comment about the UAW folks, I mean, I believe that in the movement, we know for sure that we're pretty much split between Republicans, Democrats, and Independents as to where our membership ends up as they're registered to vote. So that's not surprising to me. Now, how they vote is a different thing. I mean, the old adage is if you want to live like a Republican, you vote for Democrats. but we've seen some members go, for the most part, they vote based on issues, not based on people.
You mean in your part where you are?
Yeah. I mean, we've learned in the movement as a whole that we can't tell people who to vote for, but we can talk to them about the issues and how the issues affect them. And in most cases, members will vote their interests.
But they also don't vote their interests. Isn't that right, too? That's been a big problem, that they don't vote their interest.
Well, there is some hardcore, let's be real. I mean, no matter what you're dealing with, you got some hardcore that's going to vote against their own interests because of their own beliefs. But for the most part, the majority of the union members, when you educate them on the issues, and again, it's a difference between telling people go vote for Joe versus talking to them about how the actual issues impact them. When they're educated on the issues, for the most part, they vote the right way. When you just tell them to go vote for Joe, they do what they want to do. You know, and this issue of the fight for 15, it's not a union battle. This is a society battle. The jobs that we have left in this country and the growing jobs in this country are mostly service sector jobs. And with these service sectors, they've been historically underpaid jobs, and people have for years said that these are young kids in these jobs. And what we found out in most cases, many head of households are in minimum wage jobs, and they're unable to take care of their family on these wages.
Are we talking about something like in Walmart, where Walmart instructs people on how to go down and get the food stamps and other different things?
That's right. We're supplementing Walmart and what they should be doing for their workers, while we think we're getting a better deal by paying, 50 cents cheaper for an item at Walmart. Our tax dollar is putting another dollar in Walmart's pocket by paying for health care or supplementing the food with food stamps or some other type of benefit that our tax dollar is taking care of their workers that they should actually be taking care of.
One of our other guests just got in here, Terry, and this is Joan Simmons, and we want to welcome her. We're in the first part. You're on with Terry Melvin. He's out in Albany, New York, and you're on, of course, with Gary Earl Ross. And we have been talking the first part about what union is saying. We were just talking about, Terry was busy saying that it's a belief issue with some union members that don't always necessarily maybe vote their interests and sometimes vote their beliefs. I was going to go to Gary because you and Terry both kind of work in the same thing. And Joan, you have been involved in this a little bit too in some union issues. Why don't we go to you, Terry? You were a union steward for a long time.
For a long time. For 35 years, I was a union rep before I retired. I was a union rep for United University Professions.
Do you see the same way that Terry's just been talking about?
My union was largely university professionals, and we didn't have the same types of concerns as people, say, who work at Walmart. We did have many delegate assemblies where we discussed the issue at a place like Walmart, and there were two ways of thinking. Boycott Walmart because they don't pay their workers, or go to Walmart because we want to support the workers who are underpaid, but we want to support them somehow. So there were two ways of looking at that. And you're right, Walmart is the single biggest group of food stamp recipients in the nation. And Walmart does make a habit of teaching people how to apply for benefits. And also in their manuals for management, they are particularly good at union busting. So they have not been the greatest stewards of the basic middle class. They are raising their wage in all fairness to them.
To $15, or just maybe not quite.
I thought they were going up to like 10 or 11, not 10 15. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't think they were going up to 15.
Joan, you want to just go ahead. Like 10?
I was going to say good afternoon, everyone. Thank
good
you.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for having me, Mary. I think, unfortunately, I wasn't in on the beginning of the conversation, but I think part of the problem with unions is branding, and the mentality is just like anything else. It's a carryover from decades ago, and they haven't done a very good job
of branding themselves. What do you mean by branding?
Well, you know, people. I hear people, especially now, referring to teachers' unions as all they care about is the money and their wages and their pensions and whatever.
Teachers all along have been disparaged to a big degree. Never in my lifetime have I seen teachers so disparaged by particularly conservatives and Republicans.
Well, I think that they see, because the unions are a bloc, because they vote and their membership votes in a bloc, particularly the Republicans tend to see them as the enemy. and the way that they can, well, the what the terminology is union busting, unfortunately. But I don't think that they have, I still think that there's a place for unions in our work environment. I don't think that we've gotten to the point as a country where there's an equal distribution of wealth.
Well, we certainly haven't, that's for sure.
Okay. So long as you've got see, we're going to, right now the taxpayers are supporting people that make minimum and below minimum wage. We're supporting them because they are drawing benefits. So we're supporting them. And the problem I have with that is you've got these mega million-dollar companies making profits, and yet we, our taxpayers, are supporting their income. And so,
by supporting their workers.
Exactly. So, let the Walmarts and the McDonald's and all these other organizations step up to the plate and share.
Terry, is that what you're talking about, basically? I'm talking about the word share.
Well, I mean, when you look at the rise in the of unionism, when we were at our highest peak as unionists, when we were at 35% of the workforce being unionized, that is the highest peak of the middle class in this country, where wealth was shared pretty equally amongst the all levels of citizens in the country. What we have right now is the biggest disparity between the highest paid people and the lowest paid people than we've ever had in the country's history, and we're at the lowest level of unionization percentage-wise in our history in quite some time. So there's clearly a correlation between the density of unionized workers in this country and the distribution of wealth in the country. And that's where unions play the most key role, which is even and off the playing field. Nobody's saying that in a capitalist society that those that at the top shouldn't make a fair share, but everybody should share into what's being made, particularly those that are doing the work that's making the profit for the one at the top.
Does racism play any part of this, you, Gary?
Well, racism plays a part in those areas where you have a fairly large percentage of African American or other peoples of color who are members of unions. For example, in the United Auto Workers and in some of the teachers' unions, they are large numbers of blacks.
What about the postal workers? You know, if it wasn't for the middle class, if it wasn't for the post office, it wouldn't be any black middle class.
I agree with you as the son of a postal worker. But I do want to say that one of the issues is that unions have not completely evolved. And what's happened is that frequently in terms of, say, steel making or other kinds of labor unions, a fair number of African Americans were involved in those unions in those plants because there were jobs that did not require specific educations or skills, and workers banded together. That's kind of the early 20th century model of the union. And I think unions collectively have not evolved to a 21st century model.
Is that what Joan was talking
about?
Exactly.
Was
she talking about branding?
Yeah,
let's talk about teacher unions for an example. Teacher unions follow the basic union thing, which is to secure their members, and that's certainly a proper, appropriate, and desirable thing.
But isn't that what all unions do?
Right. Let me. But. Mm-hmm. Teachers' unions, however, I think must evolve into a more professional union where they're involved in professional development and where they police themselves the way that, say, the American Medical Association does. Mm-hmm. And this is the horror story. It's not typical by any stretch of the imagination, but there are things, I think in New York City they call them rubber rooms, where they take teachers who have been problematic in terms of, let's say, inappropriate relationships with sixth grade students. Mm-hmm. And while they're going through the process of revoking tenure, these teachers will spend a couple of years maybe sitting in what they call a rubber room so that they just
like
show
the outhouse
up and they get paid. Unions, I think, professional unions have to supervise their members in such a way that those kinds of things don't manifest, because that gives conservative forces a chance to say, look, this is all they care about. Keeping somebody in a position. And I think unions have to care about keeping the profession solid as well.
I want all of you to feel free to join in anytime you feel that a point you want to make, you know, feel free to do so.
Let me clearly jump in on this piece. Speaking from the point of view as a state Fed secretary treasurer, and looking at what's going on with the teachers union. Now, every union has a responsibility to protect their members, but the teachers union has never said that they want bad teachers in the classroom. What they've said, and I come from, my background is from the public sector also, and what they said is, you, employer, just do, tenure does not mean, and Gary can attest to this, tenure does not mean that you got a permanent job forever. Tenure just means that somebody can't walk in the door and say you're out of here just because they don't like what you're wearing.
Exactly.
Or what you said or
exactly.
How you look. Tenure means that there's a process that must go through. Now, what happens is you get lazy administrators that don't want to go through the process, and rather than going through the process of trying to coach somebody that may be wrong to see if they can correct the negative behavior and then trying progressive discipline with the individuals, rather than going through that process, you got lazy administrators that just sit back and just say, well, I'm not going to do anything because they're not going anywhere. And that's how we end up with bad teachers. And the teachers union has never supported the theory that they want bad teachers in the classroom. We want, as unionists and as part of that organization, we want the best teachers in the classroom teaching our children. And personally, I take offense to the society, not this discussion, but society, who anybody, wherever you are in society, you got there because some teacher taught you something. And for us as a society to let the far right turn this whole conversation around to the few bad teachers and the lazy administrators that don't want to do their job, and rather than calling administrators to task and making them do their jobs, which is to police the classroom, to make sure the teachers are doing what they should be doing, to make sure they're meeting certain standards, and when they're not, to correct their behavior, rather than them doing those things that they should be doing, they're going to sit back and just wallow and say that, oh, well, they're tenured, so they're not going anywhere, so I'm just not going to do anything. And we allow them to get away with that.
Either one of you can jump in whenever you want.
Let me, Terry, let me just say, you know, it's interesting to see the perspective from someone who's worked in the public sector as opposed to somebody that's worked in the corporate world. And I've spent my 30-plus years working in the corporate world and was the first female labor relations officer for a major airline. And I was the designee for 3 regional vice presidents and the president of the food service division. 99% of the people that I encountered, and I heard grievances and decided them. Mm-hmm. And I would say 99% of the grievances were males. I was in New York City at the time, and I had part of Kennedy, part of LaGuardia, and part of Newark. And I can say in all sincerity that I encountered, it was kind of an awkward position, because people would say, well, how can you be fair and impartial when the company is paying your salary, right? Mm-hmm. But you had that little book. It's called a contract. Mm-hmm. And that contract specified in, for example, if it were a disciplinary issue, the steps that were to follow.
Right.
And even the bad ones, even the bad supervisors, okay, knew that even if they implemented those procedures poorly, they had to follow A, had to B, had to follow A, and so on and so forth. So in a lot of instances, I would look at supervisors who are presenting the company's case, and I think to myself, you know, a lot of these issues, you know, had been dealt with for the last 10-20 years over and over and over again. Supervisors doing hourly rate of work, that kind of stuff. And I think to myself, you know, what would happen if you didn't have that little book, the contract, and you didn't require them to go from point A to B to C before, for example, they suspended someone or terminated someone?
Well, you know, mm-hmm. teachers also have contracts. And certainly I know that, Terry, you've worked with contracts, and Gary, you certainly have too as a union rep.
I used to dream about my contract. let me say, Terry, I agree with you that there's a lot of lazy administration that happens in school settings. I can't speak to the corporate world because I've never been involved in the corporate world. But in school settings, university settings, public schools, and I've been members of, well, university union for most of my career, but I did start teaching in the public schools. There is a lot of lazy administration that somehow doesn't follow through. One complaint administrators have, as you said, well, there's not much I can do about this, so I'm not going to do anything. And that's really a cop-out on the part of administrators. But the union's position is also kind of a cop-out in, well, we're going to safeguard everybody. We need to police ourselves. We need to be able to take our members aside and say, this is ridiculous. This hurts everybody. We need to fix this. And without having a process that drags on. When I was a union rep, I looked after my people, which was my job. But in my 35 years, I can't say no grievances were ever filed for our place. They were. And I wasn't the only union rep. I never filed a grievance. What I did was try to work a problem out before it got to that particular point. People would come to me, blank is happening, let's do it. Okay, I'll go talk to an administrator. Let's see how we can work something out so we don't have to go down
the grievance
route.
Isn't that called negotiation?
To me, I don't know, I would call it negotiating, I'd call it being professional, because in the long run, the outfit that employs us both, whether we're administrators or faculty, whether we're management or labor, the outfit that employs us both is going to rise or fall based on what we do, and you need to find a way to work together. I tried to do that, but
Well, I don't think that. First of all, I don't think it's the union's responsibility to police their membership. They are there. They negotiated a contract there to make sure that it's enforced. On the other hand, management has a responsibility, and that is to adhere to that agreement that was negotiated. So, yes, there are a lot of, you know, I can't tell you how many grievances I heard where I could have written the decision in my sleep. I heard it so many times. Mm-hmm. Now, is that a waste of company's money and resources? When it shouldn't have ever gotten to as far as me. But on the other hand, these individuals are paying their dues, and they expect some representation. They don't want to hear.
They want their day in court.
Yeah, they don't want to hear, listen, I heard that 18 trillion times before, and you're not going to win this. They deserve their day in court. And so I'd sit there and I'd listen to, you know, repeatedly the same scenarios. And like I said, before I'm on my way back to the office, I'm thinking, I've written that decision already. But again, it's not the company's responsibility to do more than adhere to the contract that was negotiated. The union's responsibility is to make sure that the contract that they negotiated is enforced equitably.
Well, Terry, as a person who really is in the driver's seat, now you're Secretary Treasurer of the New York State AFL-CIO. You're also president of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. How much of that do you agree with Joan?
Well, I mean, I think I'm somewhere between the middle of where Gary and Joan are, because, I mean, when I was a local president a few years ago, when someone came into me and I checked out the facts, if it was something as simple as a time and attendance issue, Well, I may go before management and argue a very strong case about why this person did what they did and why they should deserve to get a second chance. But what the management people don't know is when I met with that individual and went over the case with the individual, I reamed that person out before I went to management and said, this is not acceptable. This is not acceptable behavior. And I think more union folks have that theory because when I was at the developmental center in West Seneca, when I was a local president, I understood that we had to keep that place open, which means while we had a contract that we expected management to live up to, we had to live up to our responsibility as workers.
Or they wouldn't have a job.
Or they wouldn't have a job. I mean, they close the place down, you don't have a job. Mm-hmm. And that's a key part. I mean, we have a role as unionists to make sure whatever is going on, whatever entity that we're serving, continues to go on. And that's what blows my mind when people say, don't unionize because they're just going to take your money and close down the factory. Why the heck would we want to close down the factory? We want to continue the employment of the people that we're representing every day.
But well, I think that's what I was saying about branding. It's not so much it's the philosophy and the marketing, if you will, of the unions and their evolution in terms of marketing themselves, that old mentality of, and that picture of unions. And I think they're actually probably more critical today than ever.
Well, you know, in the case of, we're talking a lot about the demise, you know, where unions were once very powerful, like the 30s and 40s and 50s, mm-hmm. even 60s. But has unions simply just been out-hustled by Republican right-wingers in what they're trying to do as far as branding is concerned, if nothing? Like, we hear more talk about terrible teachers than anything else. But we have another union situation, or like Gary was talking about, like something is a professional type of union. Police benevolent associations all over. Mm-hmm. You know, their members and many of their members, and some of them are just outright criminals almost. They would just have on a badge and a gun and can get away with a lot of things. What is the difference there? No one is blaming. You can't even get a policeman in court in front of a grand jury even charged with anything, let alone convicted of anything. It's a very rare case.
Well, it's
well, Mary, first of all, you have to understand the attack on unions have nothing to do, from the right I'm talking about, really has nothing to do with should people have a right to come together and collectively bargain. That ain't the issue. That's what they want to tell you, but that ain't the issue. The issue of the attack on unions has everything to do with trying to break down and melt down the political power that unions use in elections.
Yes. What about, is that the case in Milwaukee, though, Terry? Was that, because that's certainly what Walker did in Milwaukee.
In Wisconsin,
Wisconsin. He went after unions.
Yep.
And what he was really wanted was to get rid of their bargaining rights.
No. He was trying to break the unions. By taking away the bargaining rights, you break the union. Therefore, they lose their political clout because they lose the funding that they use to play in the political campaign. It's all about politics. This has nothing to do with collective bargaining. Collective bargaining, if you take away the one thing that unions do for their members, collective bargaining, you then can break the union. And that's what they're trying to do. It's not about that issue. It's about the political money that's going to the Democrats in most cases rather than the right wing.
Because nobody breaks the Koch brothers.
Away,
because nobody breaks the Koch brothers is right.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, but again, that's what I'm talking about. That's what I mean about the mentality isn't so much, it's the fact that unions tend to vote in blocks, and they are very powerful.
Well, so do Republicans.
Okay, but I'm just saying that labor unions, I have some bones to pick with them, too. Mm-hmm. You know, I've stood with a group for a couple of weeks downtown at the
Tell us about that, because I thought you made some very good points. We talked about politicians, particularly we were talking about African American politicians.
Well, I think there was a group of us that stood down at the Uniland site on Delaware and Chippewa. We also went up to the medical complex and stood there. And because ours, and we not saw one person of color, not one. I happened to, at the medical complex, one of the few times I was up there, I stood and I finally saw a van, a truck, and it had a West Virginia license plate. Mm-hmm. And there was a gentleman who, it was winter, so it wasn't a tan. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, how many workers of color are there on this site? And I said, is that your truck? You came from West Virginia? Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah. He's in his local is 2,200 members. He's the only African-American.
Out of 2,200 members?
At his local. Okay.
What local would that be? Would that be trades?
Well, yeah. he was one of, and I don't know the job category, mm-hmm. but he was one of the heavy machine operators.
But wouldn't that still be trades? I mean,
well, Mary,
industrial it's trades?
Probably, it's probably one of the trade unions. However, there has been a lot of movement, and it depends on geographically where you are, where you see more African Americans participating in the trade unions. When you go to New York City, they have got an excellent pre-apprenticeship and apprenticeship program to bring. They have a goal every quarter of bringing so many minorities through their pre-apprenticeship and apprenticeship program to make them journeymen in their unions.
But Terry, this is for Terry and Gary as well as Joan. I want to have you reintroduce yourself too. They say in Atlanta, when you go south, as soon as you leave Washington, mm-hmm. where you see all kinds of people of color and all kinds of driving these tractors behind plows, laying bricks or putting up structures. And when you come back through Washington and you're back more or less in the northern part, all at once people of color kind of disappear.
But Mary, that has everything to do with the geographics and where people migrate to. I mean, you've got more blacks in the Atlanta area that are available to do that, and the density there would call for them to have more of those positions there than if you move up north where the density of African Americans or Latinos is lower than it is in those areas.
But Terry, like I said,
this has been a work in progress where we are seeing changes where, I'm telling you, in New York City, the leadership of these unions are not black. They're white, and they're putting together these programs to bring more minorities into the movement.
Well, let me just add something as it relates to Buffalo, particularly with this quote-unquote renaissance. A tremendous amount of federal money and state money is being given to these corporations.
Like the $1 billion project?
And they are required by law to set aside a certain percentage of that money for training and to hire in a certain percentage of minority workers. And mm-hmm. that's why we were on the move downtown trying to figure out. So here's a problem that I have. You have an administration at City Hall, and there are compliance officers that obviously are not
complying,
doing their job. So, mm-hmm. you know, the bottom line still remains that African Americans were locked out of unions for a long time.
They were locked out of some unions.
But the fact remains that that's why every time somebody turns around, they want to implement a new law or a new amendment or a new regulation. I'm just saying enforce the ones that you have on the books. And right now, the compliance, I went down to Webster Block about four or five times. And, you know, And I didn't see one minority workers. Now, the job site at Uniland, Delaware North is being subsidized millions of dollars to move a couple of blocks to occupy that space. They wouldn't allow us to picket along the Delaware Chippewa. We had to go down to Elmwood. They actually put up kind of a cloth fence so that we couldn't, you know, see in there. But I'm just saying that the problem is that in a lot of instances, yes, you're right, where the population, the density of the population might be more minority. I'm just saying regardless of the density of the population, there's a responsibility for compliance in order to get that money.
But we have basically in Buffalo a city that's headed by a black mayor. We have, I'm not sure right now how many councilmen, but I think we have in the Buffalo Common Council at least three members, I think.
Wyatt, Virgin.
I think it's three, maybe four, but so that you're saying basically that this administration is not in compliance with federal laws and rules. Now, I don't know how many of you are, I would imagine that all of you, Joan and Gary and even Terry, though you're based in Albany, but you live in this part, this neck of the woods. You probably know these people in the administration in Buffalo, probably the administration in Lackawanna as well.
Mm-hmm.
So could what Joan be saying, that seems to me to be a charge against an administration, kind of like what we saw in Baltimore, what the people talk about in Baltimore, that the place was a mess, that they can do harbors and they can do ballparks and this kind of thing, and that neighborhoods go to pot. And mm-hmm. there's no job because many of these young people who were so angry in the streets of Baltimore had no jobs, and neither did their parents.
Well, you know, I just without getting on my soapbox about that, mm-hmm. Buffalo and cities, the Blue Belt, Rust Belt, however you want to define them, Pittsburgh, born and raised there, Detroit, Cleveland, Buffalo, Baltimore. Between 1910 and 1970, something like 6 million African Americans migrated, and they call it the Great Migration, migrated from southern states to fill the manufacturing jobs in the north. And
I think that's what Terry was talking about in New York City.
Okay, and so what happens is that, you know, what we see, the deterioration and the decay, didn't happen overnight. Companies like Republic Steel, Bethlehem Steel, U.S. Steel, they were moving their operations overseas with the money long, for decades. The problem is that they left behind and this pool of workers who didn't have, who weren't prepared to move into the next level and the next industry. So now we have the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, you know, a lot of unemployed workers. But Gary, you write a lot about this in many of the things you do from historical points of view. And also I would say to Terry, you know, you've been in union movements for a lot. What do you think about what Joan just said?
Okay. She said a lot. First, mm-hmm. let's say, yeah, what happened is that as things shifted with companies moving overseas to save money, and the bottom line being the only thing that a company's concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have a circumstance where people get lost, workers get lost, because the only thing they're concerned about is how much they're giving back to the shareholders. So we've had a loss of non-skilled labor jobs over the years as factories have moved away. And that leaves us now with service sector jobs, and they were never that well represented by unions. So that's something that's been going on, as Joan said, for decades.
Wasn't that what this $15 an hour thing was that we started out with all about, and that was trying to raise up some of the level of money here?
Yeah, but, you know, just to piggyback on what Gary was saying, you know, I remember very well the quote that the future belongs to those who prepare today. And
but yeah, how do you square that though, well, Joan Terry or Gary?
But the
when
problem,
you talk about Baltimore,
what the problem is that none of these millions of workers were ever given the opportunity to move into that next industry or that next level.
I think we're still missing that. In Baltimore, they're saying the case when Martin Luther King was assassinated mm-hmm. in the 60s, and the place had, they had riots, and a lot of these neighborhoods were just like gutted. And they're still that way. Over 40 years later, they're still, mm-hmm. but yet they can build up the harbor. I mean, the example is right here in Buffalo. They all this work for the harbor, all this work for the medical corridor, all this work for downtown. You know, you go a certain path, Main Street, going west, and you see all this beautiful construction activity going on. On east, we have a lot of these neighborhoods that haven't been touched. This is the same in Baltimore. My question to all three of you was, how can you possibly justify building up harbors and corridors and different other cities, and you have neighborhoods in deterioration? They say, well, it's the fault of education. Well, Gary, you've been in education. You know, is that the fault of education? And then you, Terry, you and Coalition for Black Trade Unionists, is this your fault? Or Joan?
I don't think it's the fault of education on that. But I think it is, I mean, all this stuff is based on economics.
Yes,
and
it's class.
I believe what the mayor's goal is, and those politicians that are working hard to try to build up the harbor, is to try to infuse more money into the city so that some of those other things can be done. I mean, some of this stuff, Mary, we got to take responsibility for.
Like what?
In the country. I mean, like 30 years ago, no, let me say, I had to back this up. Like 40 years ago, when my family first moved out of the Fruit Belt onto the east side, the east side was clean. You could just about eat off the streets. You go down that same street right now, and ain't nobody on that street but people that look like us. You got dilapidated houses. You got crack houses. You got all this. The white man didn't come in and put that in there, okay? We got to take responsibility in the areas where we did something to tear down our community. Now, there are some in the community. I'm not saying everybody did this, but those that we got to take responsibility. We've got to build up, pull our own bootstraps up, and figure out what we need to do. I am so fed up. I was just giving a speech the other day, and I said, I ain't marching nowhere anymore until somebody has a game plan of what we're going to do after we march. I'm sick of marching from point A to point B, yelling and hard, beating our chest, and then everybody go home and nobody's doing anything.
Well, you know, that's what
plan.
That's what I was telling Mary.
In our community, that we start stepping up and quit pointing the finger. I mean, we got a mayor. We got a black mayor, but he can't do it all. We got a black president, but he can't do it all. What are we willing to do as citizens to stand up and make a change?
Well, that's, you know what? But you know, Terry, in all fairness, Buffalo has got to be one of the most residentially segregated cities that I've ever been in. And the concentrated poverty, to me, is the same thing as a concentration camp. You can't, on one hand, you can't, you know, the mayor of a city is a CEO equivalent in a corporation. He's responsible mm-hmm. for not only the day-to-day operations, but he's also have to be a person of vision.
Right.
Now, a city is like anything else. It's only going to be as strong as its weakest link. So just for practical purposes only, it's in the best interest to attract businesses and financing to the city by bringing everybody along. For example, this may sound trivial, but they're spending thousands and thousands of dollars putting in planters on Elmwood Avenue. Yet there are areas on the east side that don't even have sidewalks. So, yes, there's no question that people have to take advantage and take some responsibility, but level the playing field for me, okay?
Gary, you have been awfully silent in here. What do you think about these things?
Well, first of all, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a minute, because this is all what I've been saying for years, that this is class. This is nothing but class. The east side of Buffalo, which I grew up on, when I was a kid, we had all levels of income in our neighborhood.
Well, because there was segregation. Black people couldn't move away.
Right. Well, see, America is segregated. You know, you said Buffalo is one of the most segregated cities. Well, you know, I've heard people from Milwaukee say that, people from Cleveland. Just about every major city in America, northern, and I'm not sure about the southern cities, but northern cities, they're pretty much segregated. They always have been pretty much segregated. What happened was that the people did much better in the past when you had a mix of classes living in a particular area, because then the kid whose family didn't have a lot of money saw the teacher or the doctor or the lawyer who lived on the same street or around the corner and saw something to aspire to. During the turbulence of the 60s, when things got rough in the inner cities, people who could leave left.
When the middle class moved out
exactly.
to Amherst and Chittawaga.
So what's happened is that we have parts of the city in the area are segregated, but there are parts that are in my neighborhood is the University District. We're a largely black district, but we are integrated. We have a wide range of people in the district. We have owner-occupied homes. We're a solidly middle-class area. But what happened was a lot of that disappeared, and what we're left with now is a class issue. And the class issue gets worse as, say, jobs disappear in terms of factories and things like that, because class is largely the bottom line on your income. So what we have now is a circumstance where there's a certain hopelessness that creeps in, because people who don't have skills don't have job prospects and don't have any place to go. And people who do have skills and do have job prospects are doing fine, or they're doing better than others. And it's not just a matter of saying, well, let's put some money in this particular place. We need, as a society, we need to agree that there are some things that are important for us, and that goes to the schools, that goes to treating people humanely, that goes to everybody lifting everybody else up. And I'm just going to bring up one more thing in terms of unions. I had a situation many, many years ago, and the principals in it are passed away now, and I'm not going to mention their names, but there was a case, one of my colleagues had been raised by an aunt and uncle in Alabama, if memory serves. The uncle died. She wanted to go take care of the uncle. Okay, so the job said, okay, this is your uncle. The contract gives you one day to do that. And she said, but this is like my father. My parents are dead. My aunt and uncle raised me. So the administrator said, fine, you can get 5 days for that. So she went to take care of business, came back. 2 weeks later, the spouse, the aunt, dies. And she has to go again. This time, it's like, you got 5 days for an uncle before when the contract gives you one. I'm not going to give you 5 days again. And that's one of those things that it's like, this is a contract situation. And I followed through with it. And eventually the person got the 5 days, because it was, this is like the person's parent. This is a humane thing to do.
Yeah, but
and what I'm saying is that we've lost our sense of being humane, and that's partly where we need to go with this. We need to do it in terms of neighborhoods and schools and so forth. We need to understand that we're in it together, and we need to find ways to elevate.
But what Terry was busy talking about, which is kind of like going not quite in sync with what you're saying. Terry said that when he first got on the east side, the streets were clean. They were all people of color who most likely lived there. But the streets were all night, which you go to say class. And then you walk down, and now he's walking down there now, and he says he can't recognize the place because nobody gives a crap about how the property looks. Is that more or less paraphrasing you pretty good, Terry?
That's it.
Well, you know something,
Gary's saying it's more like we've lost our humanity. You're saying, in a way, I think, like, we've lost the will to want to clean up where we live. We don't give a damn.
Well, part of that is, and Mary, you and I have had this conversation, rather than building more projects, why don't we build more low-cost homes where people can rent to buy? There's no question that if when people have a vested interest in their community, that they have more inclination to upgrade the property and look after the property.
We're putting all this on backs of working people instead of maybe on administration.
Well, that again, you know, I think that what I see in I hate to sound so critical of Buffalo, but what I see is a city of lost opportunities. There are phenomenal opportunities available to the city to shine. Instead of having pockets of progress, the city should be it, and that's what people come here see.
The progress.
The pockets mm-hmm. of progress. They don't see the quote unquote other side of Buffalo. And I still say that it is the manager's responsibility to have the vision.
And you're talking about the CEO or the mayor.
Well, and I'm just saying that here we are talking about where are these people going to come from that are going to fill the jobs in the medical quarter. Well, did the future just happen or was there a plan?
I'm not sure, but I'm going to give something I'll have to apologize to my listeners for. I didn't give my guests an opportunity to explain who they were. So, Terry, since you're the farthest away, why don't we start with you? Who in the heck is... Go ahead, Terry.
What are you looking for, Mary?
Tell us who you are.
Oh, I serve as the Secretary Treasurer of the New York State AFL-CIO.
Well, first of all, you're Terry Melvin.
I'm Terry Melvin, and I also serve as the President of the International Coalition of Black Trade Unionists.
And you're also a minister, Baptist minister.
And I'm the associate minister at the Second Baptist Church in Lackawanna, New York.
And Gary, who are you?
I'm retired.
I'm retired.
I'm Gary Earl Ross. I'm a
retired
English professor, but I retired so I can write pretty much full time, and that's what I'm doing these days. Novelist, playwright, short story writer.
And a teacher of creative writing, which you said that's the only thing you're going to teach.
Well, the only class I will ever teach again is creative writing. I have some conditions. If a place wants me to come teach for them, those are the conditions. No English 101, nothing basic anymore.
And who is Joan Simmons?
Well, I can say I'm retired also, but I am also founder and president of the Niagara Frontier Movement for the Advocacy of African American Human Rights. And it is a nonprofit, non-membership organization, and our intent is to ensure that the human rights, and that includes civil and voting rights, of African American residents and citizens in the Niagara region. And I say that because we intend to make sure that the laws that are on the books are being applied and used.
Well, it's amazing how this conversation has gone so quickly, but I want to play a game of round robin and see if you can do an answer like in about 30 or 40 seconds.
Okay.
Why are we hearing so much today that we didn't hear 30 years ago about the misconduct of police? Who wants to go first?
It's simply because we have these things called cell phones now, and
mm-hmm.
people can take pictures of everything that's going on, and social media allows it to get around. These things have been going on for years. They've been going on all over the country, and it's been covered up, and we didn't have any proof, and now we have proof, and it's in our face.
That's one of the advantages of the surveillance state, one of the few advantages of the surveillance state. It's hard for miscreants to get away with wrongdoing when everybody's taking pictures.
What about you, Joan?
Well, I'm going to be the one that throws this wrench. I think I've seen in my 68 years more disrespect for people of color by all levels of not only just government officials, but public servants, police officers. And I think a lot of it has to do with the disrespect that we see of our president, If they disrespect him and threaten him, then where does that leave you and I? And I see an escalation, and I'm probably older than the two of you. I see an escalation in that level just on a day-to-day basis. I can't imagine. We can go into the history of policemen and the black community.
That's true, but why are we seeing the same results? This 30 years ago, police got away with whatever they were doing. 30 years hence, they're still doing it. Why is that?
From the moment the
And even though we've got cell phones and social media.
From the moment the first Blackfoot set down on the soil in this continent, people of color have been disregarded, dehumanized, and so forth. And it's like the level of disrespect now, it doesn't seem to be more dramatic. I mean, at least we don't have N-word hair tobacco anymore. There is that product. I've written a play set in 1925, so I've been doing a lot of research, and I've got a bunch of stuff that'll be part of that play. But black people have been dehumanized on this continent from the moment they set foot on it. And that has not changed. There has been progress. Things have changed bit by bit. But the reaction to that, I did this professional paper for Popular Culture, the Popular Culture Conference, a couple years ago on the fallout from the first black president. And I talked about all the stuff that had to do with the Tar Baby and the Secret Service's sexual impropriety that endangered his life, and Congress refusing to work with him and saying disrespectful things all the time. I went through all this stuff, and then I said they impeached him. And people stopped. They said, oh, in case you were mistaking what I was saying, you thought maybe I was referring to Toni Morrison's comment that Bill Clinton was the first African-American president. No, I'm talking about Douglas Dillman. Who? Douglas Dillman, who was the first black president in Irving Wallace's 1964 novel, The Man. Everything that happened to Douglas Dillman in that 1964 novel happened to Obama after he was elected, people saying it had nothing to do with race.
But Terry, you brought up the fact that about social media. And I would say, and as I said before, the same thing that we see that happened 30 or 40 years ago vis-a-vis police is happening today. What's only recently, what we've only had, what, three even brought up on charges, policemen, except this one policeman who shot the man in the back.
And don't forget the cop at the South Carolina gas station who shot the guy who was reaching for his wallet as instructed, and fired six shots at close range and hit him once. And he was arrested, as well as the one who shot him back in the six in Baltimore recently.
But that's very few. That's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. So, Terry, you're going to get kind of like the last word here. What do you think? Although you brought up social media, but doesn't seem like much has changed as far as making cops who act badly, bringing them to justice or even being reprimanded.
Well, let me just say this. Let me be perfectly clear. I don't think just like I said about teachers, I don't think all cops are bad. I think we got a few bad apples out there. Mm-hmm. And I think we've been treated as a people with disrespect by those bad apples out there. And I think the best thing that happened was this social media so that things can be seen. But let's not rest on that issue, because even though we saw somebody get strangled to death on social media, on TV around this world, those police officers were not even charged.
We only have about 20 seconds left, so I'm going to give Joan, you get the last word. We've only got about 20 seconds.
Well, there's no question that there are bad apples in every profession.
Right.
But what I see is a more aggressive, open disdain and disrespect. And I think it's going to be a long, hot summer.
Well, let's hope not. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to go. I'm your host, Mary Davis. I want to thank my guest, Terry, you out there in Albany. Hope everything is going well. And my threat still stands, and you gave me your word that you're going to do a TV show with me. And so did Gary Earl Ross, and I will put Joan to the same thing. So we'll be following up on this on TV next time. Thank you, Joan. Thank you, Terry. Thank you, Gary. I'm your host, Mary Davis. Stay with the station throughout your day.
You've been listening to The Mary Davis Show. If you have any comments or suggestions, please write to Mary Davis, 500 Corporate Parkway, Suite 200, Amherst, New York, 14226.